This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring pressing public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. As with each edition, this issue of the Business of Government magazine, as is its focus, the core mission of the IBM Center for the Business of Government, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's government leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities. These are the opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging and complex environment. We hope that each feature contributes in some way to advancing best practices, clarifying core public management issues, and whenever possible, presenting strategies marked by clarity and practical utility. First up, Conversation with Leaders, featuring government leaders who are changing the way government does business. From transforming the national aerospace system to managing homeland security resources, educating today's information leaders, and transforming government operations, these executives clarify and extend our understanding of the work they champion and the efforts they lead. The nation stands on the verge of a new era in aviation. The national aerospace system is one of the largest and safest in the world. It is also one of the busiest.
We never take our eye off of safety, so safety is our utmost challenge. You know, we have clearly one of the challenges moving forward. We're seeing traffic grow again. We have to find ways to expand the capacity of this national air traffic system that we have. And in order to do that, we're going to have to implement a next-gen technology shift. We're going to shift from a radar-based, literally Eisenhower-era type of navigation system to the navigation system of tomorrow. The airplanes will be equipped for it. We need to have personnel that are qualified to operate in that system, along with the technology. And it's very, the satellite-based is quite a change for us. But it'll bring us wonderful benefits. People say, well, it's going to cost some money to make this shift.
Randy Babbitt, administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, outlines the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen, explaining how it will improve the airspace system, increase capacity, and ensure safety.
Well, the next gen, if we take the really top view and start with that, we're going to transform our national airspace system from a radar-based, analog, ground-based signals for navigation into a satellite-based navigation system. And remember, we're talking about 24 million square miles of airspace. 15% of the world's traffic is in our airspace. And so this transformation is going to take, over time, almost 10 years, it's going to take us to fully implement. But at the end of it, we're going to have a safer system. We're going to have a more efficient system. Our capacity will be enhanced both in the air and on the ground. From a situational awareness perspective, the pilot now sees everything that the air traffic controller sees, along with a lot of other information.
In 2010, more than 700 million passengers flew on U.S. air carriers. With air traffic expected to increase by 50% in 15 years, and flight delays already causing disruptions in service and a loss of productivity, a revamped system is needed to accommodate future growth. A system that will let passengers fly safely with fewer delays and less congestion while reducing aviation's environmental impact. Babbitt outlined some of the key benefits of the next generation system.
If we follow the flight from leaving the gate, we have better ground management now with surveillance radar available to us. Surface detection equipment on the airport allows us to better control our ground traffic. We get in the air, we're going to use more optimized profiles to take us to our destination. Instead of driving like you would on a street, making all the turns and going over these traditional navigation points, there's no reason why everyone just can't go direct at the optimum altitude. And we have a very sophisticated computer technology that will separate the traffic for us with minor corrections. The other thing that we get is the ability to use tailored arrivals, or what we call optimized profile descents. The analogy that I make, it's the difference between walking down the steps and crossing the landings and sliding down the banister.
Safety is at the core of FAA's mission, and its commitment at pushing the bar higher and developing new safety strategies is obvious.
Well, I think safety is one of those areas where you never stop. I mean, you just have to keep trying to raise the bar at all times, and that's one of the things that we work toward. I mean, complacency is no place in aviation. This is a business where, you know, one accident is one too many.
With an expansive and varied mission, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security must manage its resources efficiently, effectively, and as one DHS. Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into reality and forging stewardship between meeting objectives and investing wisely.
Probably the simplest way to describe it is the Undersecretary for Management is the Chief Management Officer for the agency. But I really think about my job as being sort of the number one steward for good government. Really, that's what I see my job is, to constantly talk about good business practices, good return on investment. Now somebody's going to say, what investments in the federal government? Well, we make investments in people. We make investments in goods and services that we acquire. So it's my job to make sure that we're good stewards of those investments, of the taxpayers' money. So I'm always talking about good government. I think that's my job.
Boris acknowledges that many challenges he faces also bring with them opportunities.
You know, I identified essentially three major areas of attention. I think it's very important coming into an organization to provide some context, a framework for what you're going to be focused on. People want to know that. So I've tried to distill that down to some very simple notions. We're going to concentrate on very strong financial management. We're going to concentrate on good acquisition. And then finally, we're going to concentrate on our people, our human capital. Really, those are the pillars. Those are the foundation that we're going to build our success upon.
For Boris, it's about having the right tools and providing decision makers with the right information to inform their actions.
Are we doing the right kind of analysis, the right value-added analysis to help decision-makers make good decisions? Do we have the tools that inform decision-makers? You know, the department is very large. We have a very varied mission. What's the right kind of information we need for decision-makers? How are we going to collect that information? How are we going to provide it to decision-makers real-time so that we can make better, smarter decisions? Now, those tools don't make the decisions for you, but they support decision-making. The business of protecting the nation's homeland requires real-time support. So while I am not in the frontline provision of service business providing Homeland Security services, we are providing that backbone support, and I need better tools to be able to do that. What can I do to get better? That's a question I'm always asked. What can I do to get better? We need to make sure that we're providing you the tools you need to be able to work effectively and smart. I want people to get good at the basics, be good at their core school skills, and then we can help them get better.
Shaping the technology leaders of tomorrow is a core mission for the National Defense University's iCollege. Dr. Robert Childs, its chancellor, discusses how the college is positioning itself as a global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information leaders.
And the last time you interviewed me was right before our 20th anniversary. At the time, we talked about some of the things we're doing, and that made us start thinking, in all honesty, and reflecting on what we had done in the past. And we found out that we were doing more than just educating people. We were actually informing people and connecting people. And we made our name with the Chief Information Officer programs, and all of a sudden it had expanded into process improvement, enterprise architecture, emerging technologies, all of these areas. So we took a look at what we did, and we're actually becoming a global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information age leaders. It was no longer just CIOs, it was leaders. That was a huge step forward. We haven't actually changed much organizationally in numbers. We have about 85 people, 50 faculty members, 35 staff members. We're organized into departments, and the departments are organized around programs, information strategies, information assurance, Chief Financial Officer Academy. We also have IT project management, and that area is actually becoming a hot topic these days also.
Childs explains what's in a name and his institution's evolution to what is now the iCollege.
The name change came about. The president of the university, Admiral Rondo, thought that that was an appropriate name change because of the magnitude and the impact that the position has and the impact that the college is having both in the United States and internationally. And that came along with the degree-granting effort that we just completed for the Master of Science in Government Information Leadership program. We went through a very extensive three-year study, a self-study, where we had to take a look at our internal processes and go through everything that any college or university would go through for accreditation. The Department of Education had three team members come in, plus they had a three-team member of the NAESQI, which is a group of individuals that are selected by both the Department of Education and the House and the Senate. They made their recommendation to the overall 18-member committee. Admiral Rondo and I had to testify before that committee in early December. We received a unanimous 18-0 vote to grant the Master of Science degree.
According to Childs, it's all about how leaders position their organization.
I think the leader has to recognize excellence and create the environment where people can perform well and excel in the things that they're good at. I think the leader has to understand the trends and connect the dots. And I think the leader has to seal deals. The leader has to make decisions. And you try to position your organization into a place that you can take advantages of the trends and the talents that you have.
Today, local and state governments are under tremendous pressure to do more with less. As we continue to engage government executives outside the Beltway, I had the pleasure of speaking with Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, about how city government is modernizing and consolidating operations for the 21st century, and what New York is doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient.
Well, it's often easier to do creative things when you have a lot of money. Now, when you don't have much money, there's an imperative for change, but it takes some capital investment to produce really transformative change. It doesn't take any capital investment to produce incremental change. The larger issues are ones that really are based on the fact we've got a $63-65 billion, depending what year you're talking about, dollar budget. The problem is that budget doesn't really cover, the revenues don't cover the costs. And the mayor has managed to reduce operating expenses a few times. But the problem is aggravated by, as it is everywhere in the country, but particularly here, these huge overhanging retiree costs, pension and health care. And every year, more and more money goes out of the current operating budget to fill the hole in financing the pensions. And so, when the mayor first started, this number was about $1.2 billion a year. Next year, it'll be $8 billion, and then it goes up from there. So just to kind of pause and think about the scale of this, that's $8 billion in police officers and teachers and sanitation workers and social services and the like that we can't not afford because they have to pay for services that were previously given to the city of New York by its workforce. Right now, we owe an obligation to pay that bargain, but that doesn't make it affordable. And there's a really serious crunch, and today's budget is out of balance by a couple billion dollars.
The fiscal crunch presents a whole host of other challenges that require government leaders to be more innovative. Deputy Mayor Goldsmith continues.
It depends whether one's talking about kind of short-term or long-term. Mm-hmm. I mean, one really big challenge, I think, is to rework the labor management bargain in New York. I think the problem is how the current civil service system developed in 100 years since Tammany Hall intersects with collective bargaining. It manages the workers as if they're a problem, not as if they're an asset. The biggest challenge I think that I have is to try to provide the technology tools and the changes in the relationships that unlock the value of labor. And that means giving labor confidence that those changes are in their best interest. Then the challenge is how one gets innovation sanely through that maze.
For Goldsmith, innovation is only possible if we have fewer rules and more results.
Government today is a victim of its own successes, mm-hmm. right? So we're in New York City, so we should pay homage to Tammany Hall, right? You know, corruption and cronyism and kickbacks and hiring your cousins and giving contracts to your friends. So I say, well, we can't do that. That's bad. That's really bad. So let's make it difficult to be bad. So how do you make it difficult to be bad? Well, you set up a rule or two about how you should procure, right? You set up a couple of rules about how you should hire. Then you go, well, that makes sense. So if two rules are good, 100 rules are better. Well, 100 rules are good, then 1,000 rules are better, right? And then so 100 years later, literally 100 years later, you're in a forest of rules. And the way you have made government more honest and the way you have stopped the abuse of discretion is by stopping the use of discretion. So if you don't have any discretion to use, you can't often abuse it, but nor can you actually solve a problem. This is what gives credence to red tape, right? You have a problem, I don't care. I have a rule, right? And so I can solve your problem, but that would cause me to violate my rules, right? So the question then becomes, can you change the way we operate to inject more discretion in the system and still hold people accountable? And I think with the analytic tools we've discussed earlier in the interview, you can do that, right? You can look at the outliers. You can look at the way they analyze and make folks analyze, make decisions. You can give supervisors real-time data. And therefore, the post-progressive era will be an era that will be more discretion, more problem-solving, fewer rules, but an accountability system that's driven by analytics and the ability to study the way people make their decisions.
Next up are Profiles in Leadership when a special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Over the last 6 months, we've interviewed a wide variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. In this edition, we introduce you to five leaders who joined us on the Business of Government Hour to discuss critical issues facing their agencies. They are indeed profiles in leadership, and here's a glimpse. Chad Foljam, Chief Information Officer at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, focuses on delivering reliable and effective technology solutions to his agency.
Well, the FBI, again, has five branches. So as one of the five executive assistant directors, we serve as part of the senior leadership team with the director, the deputy director, and the associate deputy director. So any major strategy decisions or any investments we're going to make are done really at that level. When you look at the role of a chief information officer in the federal government, it does vary from place to place. I feel very fortunate with the backing that I've received from the director and the deputy director that we not only oversee the funds for IT and the policies, but also support the infrastructure and the portfolio of applications that support the various missions that we perform. Right now, of the almost $8 billion that is invested in the FBI for the various missions that we do carry out, about $1.4 billion is spent in the information technology area. My specific roles as a CIO is to provide leadership and a strategic direction, a vision, if you will, for where we're going, is to make sure that we have the right people, the right investments. And then with our portfolio, we have a governance process that includes a board called the Investment Management Board that we vet all major investments in IT projects.
Making sound IT investments rests on a clearly articulated strategic vision and a plan of action. Here's Foljam.
We actually have a published IT strategic plan, and it breaks down into five major areas: infrastructure, information sharing, transforming our workforce, improving IT management, and enhancing that customer satisfaction. The last couple of years, we have focused quite a bit in all these different areas, everything from trying to put together a plan to consolidate data centers. Last year, we completed a project called our Next Generation Network. NGN was a complete replacement of the domestic network at over 800 locations in about a 10-month period. We put out all new gear, all new cryptology. We moved to an MPLS design and increased the bandwidth pretty dramatically. we're now finishing out a second major program called Next Generation Workspace. And that's where we actually did the field first, because we try to feed the warfighter first. And we're in the process of doing headquarters now. But it's putting out all the latest and greatest unified communication and collaboration tools. So bringing instant messaging, voice over IP, web collaboration, document collaboration into the FBI's classified network. We have had some major wins in our systems management area, information security, project management. You go down the list of things that we set out to do, we've hit them all pretty hard.
Meeting mission is a key focus for Alejandro Mayorkas, director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. He spoke to me about his effort to ensure the integrity of the U.S. immigration system, forging a well-managed, modern system.
Our agency was created as part of the Department of Homeland Security following the Homeland Security Act of 2002. And it stems from the Legacy Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS. And our portfolio is really the administration of our country's legal immigration system. We also have the responsibility of ensuring the integrity of the system that we administer and safeguarding our national security. And it is in those latter regards that we fit into the Department of Homeland Security's overarching mission of securing our homeland. I am the leader of the agency, and so in that regard, I represent the agency in public, and I help steer the course of the agency. Let me say that because of my style of management, I would describe myself as the chief collaborator, because I believe in leadership through collaboration and through teamwork.
Mayorkas leads an organization guided by a set of core principles that will assist his agency to successfully meet its mission.
I'll mention it first, and that is consistency. Our workforce deserves consistency, and the communities that we serve deserve consistency, and that is something that we need to achieve. It is not necessarily our greatest strength currently, but we are certainly devoted to achieving it. Efficiency is a second principle, and I identify them, Michael, in no particular order. But efficiency is something that is incumbent upon us as a public service agency. We have customers, and therefore it is customer service. But there's also another principle at issue, why it is so important that we be efficient. Because we spend customers' money, and we therefore have to be very careful in how we spend our money. Integrity is, of course, another core value, another core guiding principle. Protecting the integrity of the system from those who seek to exploit it, but it also speaks, of course, to the integrity of our workforce. We are guardians of the public trust, and therefore integrity is of critical importance. And the fourth is transparency. We serve the public, and we have to be held accountable to the public, and to that end, we have to be transparent in the information that we provide and in how we conduct our business and why.
Conducting his agency's business requires USCIS to modernize its processes. Here's Alejandro Mayorkas, director of USCIS, on forging the U.S. immigration system for the 21st century.
Michael, we are a paper-based system. And so we embarked a number of years ago on an effort, a modernization effort that was termed transformation, because it really is transforming our agency from a paper-based system to an electronic environment. And it will allow our customers to access us through computer rather than the actual submission of completed paperwork. And the efficiencies gained by that are obvious from a processing perspective. But there's also successes that are to be achieved through that modernization in our efforts to combat fraud and help safeguard our national security.
The U.S. federal government is facing unprecedented challenges, so stable labor management relations are needed more than ever.
Well, the FLRA, Federal Labor Relations Authority, is the sole agency responsible for federal sector labor management relations. We're modeled, if you will, organizationally after the National Labor Relations Board. We have a similar mission. Theirs is private sector jurisdiction. Ours is federal sector. So federal agencies, federal unions, we have jurisdiction over the labor relations and labor law of 1.6 federal non-postal employees. We are a creation of the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978 under President Carter. Prior to that, some of our function, not all of it, but some of it was performed under executive orders dating back to President Kennedy in 1962.
That was Carol Waller-Pope, chairman of the Federal Labor Relations Authority, who spoke to me about the ways her small but mighty agency continues to improve labor-management relations in the federal government.
We're small but mighty. We take our mission seriously because what we recognize is if there are unhealthy labor-management relations in the federal sector, then it affects the federal government's mission. Certainly, we're structured in a way that we have 7 regional offices under the auspices of the General Counsel, which is a separate component. We are some 130 employees currently. I became chairman of the agency in 2009, February 2009, appointed by President Obama's chairman. I was a sitting member of the authority. I began my political role with the agency in 2000 as a member and became chairman after the election in 2008. We're struggling to increase our budget and improve our mission. We've had success. We have support from the Office of Management and Budget and the administration. I think there is a recognition that we have an important mission because if there's a lot of labor unrest, then it affects the mission of the respective agencies.
Pope's focus is on reinvention, not restoration. She's working to make the agency flexible and strategically poised to address the needs of this changing environment.
Challenges or opportunities. I inherited the agency, I would say, in the lowest point in its 30-year history. So that was a challenge. I think the biggest challenge was that I walked into the door, literally, but I was already there at the agency, when we were the 34th small agency in the employee satisfaction ranking out of 34. My tagline, if you will, was, "We have nowhere to go but up." And it was a challenge. I had been there during the low years of employee morale, and I knew that you don't turn around a culture or improve morale overnight.
Her vision for the future focuses on revitalization, reinvention, and reengagement.
The revitalization, reinvention, and reengagement really came about around our lack of really mission performance. We all know that success breeds success, and employees feel good about their workplace if it's a thriving workplace and you're accomplishing your mission. We were not doing that. And so the revitalization, reinvention, and reengagement seemed to fit not my vision, but what our shared priorities were for the agency. I just tried to come up with a way to describe it internally and externally. It's hopefully representative of all of what the issues were for us and for the parties that we serve.
The 2008 financial crisis and its lingering impact triggered the most severe economic recession in 70 years. The U.S. Department of the Treasury has played a critical role in the federal government's response. Dan Tanglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management, details his efforts managing resources and operations for the federal department charged with reforming the financial system.
The job has two formal appointments as the Assistant Secretary of Management and the Chief Financial Officer. And really what my office does is provide resources for the entire department. Those are financial resources, human capital resources, contractual resources, and technological resources. We also then focus on things like small business participation, records and information management, and then just the operations of the departmental offices. Departmental offices is about 1,700 people, $300 million program. My office is this great combination of wholesale in doing, you know, the budget for the Treasury Department, the financial statements of the Treasury Department, which include all the assets and liabilities of the federal government. We roll them up. And then retail. And that means literally retail in the form of the cafeteria in the main Treasury Department building. So I joke, if I can't get any traction on the wholesale, I can go down and worry about the menu in the basement of the main Treasury building.
Tanglerini outlines the many challenges he faces in his role at Treasury.
So all three of our top challenges, I would just condense into the one big issue that we've been dealing with as a department, and that's the global financial crisis. And frankly, for us, our job is in providing the resources and the support and the systems and the structures for the department to contend with that, to contend with, you know, the early on issues of trying to grapple with it, turn it around, and then our efforts now to continue to foster the recovery and stabilize the recovery and push economic growth. And so really our job is to support those incredible hardworking, smart people in the Department of Treasury who are pushing forward on the administration's efforts, our collective efforts, frankly, to improve the economy.
In making this happen, the Department of the Treasury established three priority performance goals that seek to drive its focus and achieve measurable results. Here's Tangalini.
Number one in our high-priority goals is repairing and reforming the financial system and really expanding economic opportunity as kind of a related component to that. The next is increasing voluntary compliance in our tax system. And then also, as part of that, simplifying the tax code and working to, you know, improve the tax code and continually focusing on efforts to make voluntary compliance an easier default location. The final one is increasing our paperless transactions. And in many ways, these three kind of high priority goals reflect the three kind of levels that we work at. One, the Treasury Department works at this national and international level where we have an oversight relationship. The next level, the increasing voluntary tax compliance, really deals with how Treasury interacts with the American public directly as a service provider. What we want to do is make sure that we're constantly working on that system to make it fairer, to make it easier. Third one, the increasing paperless transactions and saying that we have a responsibility to really improve the way the Treasury Department operates at a fundamental level. And one of the ways we want to get at that is ask ourselves, what are those business processes we employ? Could we reduce the amount of paper we're moving around, paper being a proxy, frankly, for inefficiency?
Realizing efficiencies and improving business operations has become an imperative at the U.S. Department of Defense. Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at the DOD, offers insights into the way it's improving its business and systems operations to provide the best mission support possible to the armed forces.
There's been a lot of energy in recent years about the importance of the sort of business portfolio of the Department of Defense. What's the business of the department and how is that run? About 2 years ago, in 2008, a statute created the Office of the Deputy Chief Management Officer, directed the Deputy Secretary of Defense to also serve as the department's Chief Management Officer, created a Senate-confirmed position called the Deputy Chief Management Officer, and then created chief management officers in each of the military departments. You know, the whole idea is to align and improve the business operations of the entire Department of Defense. How can we look at improving both effectiveness and efficiency? How could you help others to transform if you weren't willing to be transformative yourself? The actual office of the Deputy Chief Management Officer is pretty small. And then there's a much larger business transformation agency that is sort of the hands and feet and execution agent for the organization. And then this heavy reliance upon the military departments, the key functional owners.
Winogrand focuses on his specific efforts.
And I'm really focused on is this looking at the end-to-end processes of the organization and moving away from a world where we only look at things by organization or by functional view. And we only look at things as systems that have to be built or bought. But instead, we look about how you optimize processes. It is the first time that the Department of Defense has really ever taken that strategic look. Other key things for us are strategic planning, a key emphasis on strategic planning for the entire organization, creating a culture that's outcome-based and has good performance measures in place, and then several sort of key initiatives that are near and dear to all of our hearts, reforming IT acquisition, electronic healthcare, and a number of other sort of functional issues.
Winogrand recognizes that he faces many challenges.
There's this issue about alignment. We have come from a world that was highly disconnected, if you will, or certainly decentralized. You have this sort of conflict of verticals and horizontals. And so this key issue of the power of alignment and how do you get an entire enterprise as big as the Department of Defense to be focused on common goals and outcomes? Because if you can think first about the process change, then you can drive how you insert in technology to get the work done. Sort of coupled with that is this idea about we've grown very used to, in the IT space, a systems view of the world. And we move very rapidly to the sort of bright, shiny object known as the IT system. And we start to forget that what we were really trying to do was create an outcome. It's about thinking about outcomes and then moving to a more service-oriented world. The third one is, you know, sort of the cliche, but one we can never lose sight of, and it's the cultural change stuff. The issues about creating and maintaining the proper sense of urgency so that you can have speed and agility, and the issues about transparency and the sort of low-trust environment that we all still live in today in big organizations, which exacerbates that first problem of personal control.
Dave Winogrand elaborates on DOD's strategic management plan and the five core business goals identified in it.
The strategic management plan has been a seminal moment for us. How can we make sure that the business of the Department of Defense is aligned, integrated, improving, and how would we know that? The strategic management plan is the first venture, I would say, about a realized strategic management process for the entire Department of Defense. And as you mentioned, there are five major themes. There's supporting the all-volunteer force. So think about things like quality of life issues and improving medical care and electronic health records, supporting contingency business operations. So what are we doing to reduce the need for cash on the battlefield? What are we doing to improve in theater contracting? The third one is reforming the DoD acquisition and support processes. So that's got some really interesting stuff about IT acquisition reform, energy efficiency, export controls. The fourth one is enhancing the civilian workforce. So how can we do things like shortening the hiring process, shortening the time it takes to get security clearances? And then the fifth one is strengthening financial management. So audit readiness, accuracy of payments. And as I said, it's been a big step forward. And there's this tight coupling from the QDR down about a goal and then the performance measures and how those would tie to the budget.
Next up, perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. How is the federal government leveraging award prizes to spur innovation and solve tough problems? Pick up the latest Senate report, Managing Innovation Prizes in Government, and find out. Drawing on such successful efforts like the Lunar Lander Challenge and DARPA's Grand Urban Challenges, this report offers practical insights and recommendations for the design, implementation, and evaluation of innovation prizes in government. You can order or download a free copy of Managing Innovation Prizes in Government and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Telework has been touted as a winning strategy for government. In fact, a study by the Telework Research Network claims potential savings of nearly $3.8 billion. In a recent IBM Center report, Implementing Telework, Lessons Learned for Four Federal Agencies, Professor Scott Obermeyer presents case studies of federal agencies who have successfully implemented telework in their organizations. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Government leaders need to use the instruments of national power to provide present-day security while setting the conditions for a secure future. Leaders are responsible for envisioning, shaping, and safeguarding the future, creating clarity amidst uncertainty. This is no small feat, and it's made increasingly difficult in the 21st century, where rapid, unforeseen change seems to be the only constant. In this inaugural piece, we seek to provide critical insights that will help national security leaders. To do this, we present the perspectives of two leading thinkers, Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni. Both bring a rare combination of practical and reflective erudition. We hope that their perspectives present new ways of thinking about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century. Here's Professor Nye on power and its dimensions in 21st century world affairs.
Well, power is simply the ability to affect others to get the things you want. And there are three ways to do that. You can threaten people with coercion, sticks. You can pay them, carrots. Or you can attract them and persuade them to want what you want. And that third way I call soft power. In practice, you need to use all three, economic, military, and persuasive power, or smart, to create smart power, which is the combination of hard and soft power. We sometimes talk about power as though it's just twisting arms, but that's not adequate. In fact, if you can set the agenda for others, and if you can set or help to establish their preferences so that they want what you want, then you can get a lot done without twisting arms.
Professor Nye quite effectively uses the metaphor of a complex three-dimensional chessboard to describe the distribution of global power.
Well, no metaphor is perfect, but the three-dimensional chess metaphor reminds people that power always depends on the context and that the distribution of power is very different in each context. So power in the military area may be very different from power in the economic or in the transnational area. Let me tell you what I mean. Think of this three-dimensional chessboard and the top board of military relations among states. In that board, the Americans are the only global superpower. We're about half a world's military expenditure. Nobody can balance that power. And we're likely to remain that way for, I would say, another decade or two. So on the top board, people often say the distribution of power in the world is unipolar. Go to the middle board of economic relations among states, and it's quite clear that the world is multipolar. economics is the area where Europe can act as one entity when it wishes to. And when it does, its economy is larger than that of the United States. In addition, you have China, Japan, and others who we have to bargain with to get what we want. That's multipolar. But you go to the bottom board of transnational relations, things that cross borders outside the control of governments. That could be anything from hot money flows to criminal gangs to cyber terrorism to impersonal processes like climate change or pandemics. In that area, power is chaotically distributed. Nobody's in charge. This is the area where diffusion of power is increasing the number of challenges to governments.
When he joined me on the Business of Government Hour, Professor Nye explored characteristics of soft and smart power.
Well, on the soft power dimension, it grows largely out of a country's culture, its values when a country lives up to its values, and from its policies when the policies are seen as legitimate in the eyes of others. So sometimes you can find that a country will have values which are attractive, but policies which at least temporarily are unattractive. We gain soft power from our culture and values. Well, smart power simply means the ability to combine hard and soft power into effective strategies in different contexts. And if you look at basically the policy statements of the Obama administration, there is a strong desire to integrate, in this case, the hard power capacities of the Defense Department and the softer power capacities of the State Department. If you go back to 2007, when Secretary of Defense Gates was still in the Bush administration, he went out to Kansas City and gave the Landon speech, in which he said the United States needs to do more in soft power. He said, we in the military can't solve all the problems that we face. We need a stronger partner in the State Department. And he said it may seem odd for a Secretary of Defense to come out here and ask for resources for state, but he said that's the way the world is.
Professor Nye underscores that we have to learn to use the instruments of government in a more coordinated fashion.
That means that state and defense are going to have to work very closely together, but so will also Treasury and others be involved. I think it's something which is now widely agreed that a smart power strategy should do this, but it's much harder to implement.
In the end, leadership is essential. General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command, spoke to me about the global leadership crisis.
I think we have a leadership crisis, and it's not just when I began my last book, I researched to begin with what people feel about leadership. I was shocked to find that somewhere around 75% to 80% of American people think we have a crisis in leadership across the board in every element of our society. And it's not just the United States. Globally, we feel that way. I think that the conditions in the 21st century lead to that. It's a much more complex and complicated world. And so to be competent, you truly have to master not just a narrow field of capabilities, but a very broad field of capabilities. Our leaders are under much greater scrutiny than they have ever been before. I think the demands from those we lead are greater now. They understand more what could be done because of the information technology, understanding of a better world. The demands are higher. Expectations are higher. The stresses, the changes, the degree to which you have to be far more competent in so many different areas, understanding the speed that you have to operate in today and the environment that requires quick decisions, mastering information technology that has overwhelmed us and made the world much smaller and tighter and well-informed, all have impacted on leadership. And so there's a different kind of leader that has to come out now. And I think the old ways of leading won't be effective in this modern world.
General Zinni identifies characteristics of a successful leader.
And I found that first of all, they understood the people they lead. They're able to operate with a greater ability to touch all the people they're with. They understand themselves better. They're much more self-aware. They seek improvement. They seek coaching and mentoring. The successful leaders, they don't assume they get it. They're constantly learning. It's a thinking environment they create. They're critical thinkers. They're systems thinkers. They're creative thinkers. They make decisions based on analysis. They recognize patterns. It's recognitional decision makers. They become more instinctive based on their ability to analyze their experiences and educate themselves. They have a tremendous set of values. They understand the importance of ethics and moral behavior. And because of the scrutiny they're under, I think institutions and leadership now are more successful. There's more demand for it now. They're strategic thinkers. They're visionaries. They look out beyond just the immediate future, the next quarter in business or the next year or two. They have a place they want to reach in a decade or two. They work the organization to that. They understand organization. They're willing to take risks. They'll change organizations. They adapt quicker. They streamline and flatten organizations. It's not the old, you know, tiered sort of Christmas tree block and wire diagram. They know that won't work. It's too ponderous. It's too slow. It isn't effective. It's hard to change. They appreciate technology, especially information technology. They understand that's where the future is. You have to master it, use it, keep up with how quickly it changes and improves. They're effective communicators, both internally and externally. They can lead through crisis and they can lead through change. It's basically the effects are the same. And recognize the fact that in this day, this, you know, very difficult, complex set of times, that in this day and age, every organization will go through significant crisis or change.
General Zinni reflects on the Goldwater-Nichols Act and its implications for the future.
I think the brilliance of Goldwater-Nichols is the fact that the integrating element was not set up as a separate bureaucracy. Most of the times when reform is needed and integration is the problem, as we saw in the intelligence problems post 9/11 and Homeland Security, the answer to integration is create another structure, add more bureaucracy, add more tiers, and that becomes dysfunctional in the end. What Goldwater-Nichols said to the services, we're not going to create a separate, the joint structure will be manned from the services. You will man it, and you will man it with people that won't come from the outside, but from the inside. You will serve tours in the joint world. I watched this from the mid-80s, Goldwater-Nichols was passed, so I left the service in 2000. I saw us go through three phases. I would describe the first phase as deconfliction. And it was a very defensive era. I mean, we began to work through this. We found some of the service issues we thought were issues you could actually resolve. So we moved into the second phase, which I think really began maybe in the early 90s, which I would call the coordination phase. We actually found, let's not just deconflict. We could actually work together. And the synergy, you know, that came from that, the efficiencies and effectiveness could be great. And then I think by the time I left, I saw true integration. So if I had a recommendation, we need to fix government. Not since the 1947 National Security Act have we had a major restructuring of our government to sort of look out to the world and face it better prepared, better organized, better processed to do it, better resourced and more intelligently resourced to do it. We need that again. It needs to be bipartisan.
Stay tuned as we wrap up this edition of the Business of Government magazine. The Open Government Directive called upon each federal agency to formulate a plan for how it intended to increase openness and public engagement in its programs and operations. The latest Senate report, An Open Government Implementation Model, Moving to Increase Public Engagement, provides a roadmap federal agencies can use to guide their efforts. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Senate report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. The U.S. workplace is undergoing a significant transition that presents uncharted territory and tremendous opportunity. The latest Senate report, Engaging a Multi-Generational Workforce, Practical Advice for Government Managers, examines six trends now occurring in the workplace and describes how leaders can successfully manage through these trends and their challenges. These are the challenges of leading a multi-generational workforce and is increasingly driven by rapid technological changes that have changed the nature of work and how it gets done. You can order or download a free copy of this report and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. In this edition of Insights, we introduce you to Julie Parity, former administrator at the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service, on how FNS is making a difference in reducing hunger while promoting better nutrition. Here's former Administrator Parity on the important mission of the Food and Nutrition Service.
The Food and Nutrition Service is my very favorite agency. I say it's the greatest agency in the federal government. My staff hears me talk about it all the time. Its mission is just so noble, to increase food security among the American public and reduce hunger. We do it in partnership with cooperating organizations. We provide children and low-income people access to food, to a healthful diet and nutrition education. And we do it in a manner that supports American agriculture and that inspires public confidence. That's our goal. Primary responsibility at the Food and Nutrition Service is to oversee the administration of the nation's 15 nutrition assistance programs. And these programs touch the lives of one in four over the course of a year. So our mission is very important, very critical to the food security of our nation. And they're at the, you know, the forefront of ending hunger and improving the nutrition and health of low-income kids and families all across the country.
Here's Julie Parity, former administrator of FNS, on public service.
You know, it's a great honor to be a public servant. My mom and my dad were in the Marine Corps. My mom, when she got out of the Marine Corps, went on to be a teacher. So I got a good dose of what it meant to be a public servant and to serve the American people. It's been a great privilege and an honor for me, and I highly recommend public service to anyone who wants to feel good about what they did day in and day out.
This edition of the Business of Government magazine offers compelling viewpoints on a variety of public management topics. John Kaminsky, senior fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, discusses the Obama administration's evolving performance revolution. Kaminsky tells us more about this so-called stealth performance revolution and the challenges facing the federal performance community.
Well, Michael, early last year, Professor Don Kettle, who's the dean of the Public Administration School at the University of Maryland, noted that the Obama administration seemed to be significantly reshaping the way the federal government governs itself and the way it manages performance. And he calls this stealth revolution. It's called stealth in part because there's not a name for this. It's not some big initiative that's being run across the government, but there's a lot of things that are going on. For example, just since the beginning of this year, the president signed a new law called the Government Performance and Results Act Modernization Act, which updates a performance law from 18 years ago. It's going to have major implications across agencies. Another is that in his State of the Union, he committed to reorganizing the government. The initial proposal is supposed to come out in early June. There was a presidential directive to expand the flexibility of administrative processes, and agencies have several months before they have to deliver plans back to the White House as to how they're going to provide greater flexibility to grantees and to small businesses and stuff. Another directive came out of the White House from the president to streamline service delivery and improve customer service. All these things, when you take them together, are having a major impact on how agencies are governing themselves.
The administration's performance agenda focuses on three elements.
One is he wants the government to focus on high priority performance goals. And he's asked agencies shortly after he took office to identify a small handful. And when you add them up across the government, there's about 125 of them from all the different agencies. And what they want to do is, rather than just making commitments, he says these are things that should be accomplished within 18 to 24 months by the people that are here. And what he wants is for them to have regular quarterly reviews that are data-driven with public dashboards so people can track the progress of what's going on. And this is sort of inspired by what's been going on in states and cities around the country. For example, the Baltimore City Stat and the Washington State process. And this tracking process and bringing people together to look at the progress that's being made and what kind of adjustments need to be made in the process is going to be something that every agency is doing. In fact, this new law that I mentioned earlier puts this process that Zients proposed a year or so ago into statute. And so this June 30th, every agency will have had to have taken their high priority goals and put them through this kind of a process. And it's going to be displayed in government-wide on a new website called performance.gov, where every agency's progress against each of these 125 or so goals will be displayed. Now, the other